Hello, and welcome to episode 11, the President's Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat, the podcast that covers the arts in Northern Chautauqua County, sponsored by the 1891 Fredonia Opera House. My name is Tom Laughlin, and I'm your host as we bring you news and information about arts events at the Opera House and around the region, including interviews with artists and creators across the county. There's nothing particularly presidential about this episode, but it's nice to contemplate the coming three-day weekend, with its chance to take an extra day for some rest, relaxation, and get yourself prepared for all the upcoming arts events in the region. As the tender green buds and shoots of spring prepare to pop, so too arts events in the region are beginning to come alive with all sorts of performances about to take place. I always enjoyed singing in choirs, probably because my voice was never truly good enough to sing solo. But I was always that pesky guy who just had a tendency to sing a little bit louder than everybody else. I sang in my college's men's glee club, and for many years I was a member of the Fredonia Catch Club, a drinking group with a singing problem. The SUNY Fredonia Choral Festival will be taking place beginning on the 19th of February, led by Dr. Vernon Huff, and featuring guest lecturer and clinician Dr. Andrew McGill from the University of Illinois. I had the opportunity to speak to both gentlemen and discuss the nuances of choral singing. It's a great privilege to be able to have these two distinguished gentlemen here to talk about the Fredonia Choral Festival coming up. First of all, Dr. Vernon Huff, who is on the faculty at the School of Music. Vern, welcome.
Thank you very much, Tom, for having me.
You bet. And also our distinguished guest who's coming to give a guest lecture and do some guest conducting from the University of Illinois, Dr. Andrew McGill. Andrew, it's good to have you.
Thank you very much.
So I think I'm going to start, first of all, with you, Vernon, to give us a little background on the annual choral lecture, the history behind that and the history of the choral festival and all that kind of stuff. So get us oriented.
Sure. Hopefully I can set the stage a little bit. This began before my time here. My predecessor, Tom, who I know you knew well, Gerald Gray.
Yes, I know Gerald well. Yeah.
Established a choral festival, and his idea was to establish a sort of a weekend of excellence in which we would bring an outstanding choral clinician and or choir to Fredonia for a weekend. There are a lot of folks in any profession who really sort of stand out and, you know, that they really have done the work. And we want to make sure that we can expose our students to them and their excellence. And one of the wonderful things about being at Fredonia is we have this excellence here, this wonderful student body. But sometimes, you know, getting folks here can be hard because of our location. So we have had Bill Reinert from Eastman, Hilary Apfelstadt, who was my mentor from University of Toronto, Greg Gentry, who was at University of Colorado in Boulder. And we have wanted to have Andrew here for 2 years to come and work with our students and then do sort of a lecture of his choosing. And some folks have done, have talked about music and health. Some folks have done a conducting masterclass, which he is asked to do. And so it's our opportunity also as conductors just to sit back and learn from some of the really influential people in the profession too. So I'm looking forward to this weekend as much as the students are.
So you've really done a great job in finding a distinguished choral conductor. Andrew, I read your bio on the University of Illinois webpage and well, you know, I mean, in common parlance, it blew me away. Your credits are really quite outstanding. And so I'm really kind of interested to have you tell us what the topic of your lecture is going to be, first of all, and then I'll ask you a couple other questions.
Yeah, well, Vernon, sort of, we talked about a few possibilities, and where we ended up is that it'll be a conducting masterclass, but it'll also be, it's a little hard to describe, but for me, one of the things that's really valuable about studying conducting is that it's a chance for every musician, whether or not they'll end up being a professional conductor, to really grapple with the expressive core of what music is. For a voice performance major, they spend so much of the time dealing with the incredible intricacies of what it means to make sound through that instrument. And for music educators, they spend so much time thinking about how to sequence things and how the psychology of learning works. But for those of us who are conductors, we get to spend most of our time just playing with what is it that makes music effective and what is it that speaks to our hearts and our souls through music. And so I think it's one of the ways in which I love having in my undergraduate conducting classes musicians who don't think they're conductors. Because in my heart of hearts, I sort of believe that what it is that makes a conductor effective is the same thing that makes an artist or a musician effective. And that the kind of work we can do together there is really about opening up the imagination and helping people discover that the imaginative way that we make music is this incredible combination of bringing ourselves to the table, but also being open to the music itself. And so one of the things the real sort of subtext of this year's lecture a little bit is, what does it mean to really listen in a way that engages us beyond just our ears, but engages us as human beings? For me, it's just, there's something about the creative process and the self-expressive process that is what I think defines us as human beings. And I think for everyone, whether or not they think of themselves as a conductor, getting to spend an hour just thinking just purely about the emotional, spiritual gestures of music is incredibly joyful and valuable thing.
Let me ask you again, Andrew, about the art of choral conducting in and of itself. You know, I mean, you look at all those voices up there, you look at the different styles of singers that you have, and your job is to get them to blend together to sound almost as one voice coming out. What's the secret sauce there? How do you get that to happen?
Well, I think, I mean, I know Vernon would know this too, because all of us who are in this field sort of have the same, we come to it for the same reasons, I think. And that's I think maybe the biggest misconception I would say there is about choral music is that we get people to sound unified by thinking about what we need to take away from each individual voice to make them fit together. And in fact, I think what really works when you're being effective and skillful is you're asking everyone to sort of fully bring everything they have. But what we're doing is we're finding a unified vision of what a piece of music is, mm-hmm. and that we're discovering together what Bach meant. I mean, the reason why we all revere Bach as a composer isn't just because he wrote such amazing counterpoint and had such an amazing musical mind. It's because he understood something about human psychology and the human experience that resonates with all of us really deeply. And that I think our main job as conductors is to help unify a room in the act of exploring that thing and discovering in this piece of music, what does Bach tell us about what it means to understand guilt and shame and freedom and the way that our spirits soar when we feel released from those things. And that by finding the human impulse that lies behind great art, there's this magic thing that happens that we start being aware of each other in a way that is, you know, one of the greatest stories about being a choral musician is that it's about creating community. And that when that community is created, the unifying of the voices takes care of itself to a large extent. That the biggest thing we have to bring is an awareness of the other and an awareness of ourselves, you know, that we have to be. And that's, I think, the thing that makes choral music both most challenging but also most rewarding, is that for me, it's sort of the freest moment of being completely in touch with how I feel deeply about something, but without the ego that normally accompanies that. And that I'm also completely aware of how my fellow human beings are interacting at the same moment. And for me, that's just the most uplifting and sort of joyful experience I have in my life. And so to get to share that with our students and our singers and our colleagues is just an incredible privilege.
Vernon, what about you? How do you react to that? And maybe specifically, you can talk to our own Fredonia students. I mean, when you're getting them to sing together, you know them personally. You see them every day in the hall. What is it that you have to work with to get them to get that blend that you're looking for?
Sure. And when I hear my students use the word blend, I will stop whatever I'm doing, whatever lecture, whatever class I'm doing. I will sit down and pull a chair over and I will say, what does blend mean to you?
Ooh. Ooh.
And I have always, I've gotten 100 different answers. Because to some people, it can mean vowel unification. To some people, it can mean coming together. Some people, it can mean diction. You know, Robert Shaw had a lot to say about what blend meant. But what we try to do at Fredonia, and I think my colleagues would agree with me here, is we start with the process, because in art, you know, I walk in the room and I have the piece memorized. They've never seen it. So it really is sort of a sun and planets model at the beginning. And we walk in and, you know, we're the center of things. And over the course of days and weeks and months, I like to see myself get smaller and smaller and smaller and not at the center. And we're all relating and we're all working together towards a common goal. So that I could step out of the room and you know what? The music would still go on. It's my job, because of my experience, to help bring the art out of the students. And then I give it over to them and we all make it together. And that's a pretty incredible part of what we do, I think, here.
Andrew, your career has been, goes through, as I mentioned, a lot of different repertoire. You've got to tell me, I've been dying to ask you this, so I'm going to ask you, what is Bang on a Can All-Stars? Now, that really caught my
eye. Sure. Bang on a Can All-Stars is one of the best new music groups in New York City. And they were founded by a consortium of three people who've become really important composers, Michael Gordon, David Lang, and Julia Wolf. And Julia and David both won the Pulitzer Prize in the last 10 years for pieces they wrote for vocal ensembles. And so Bang on a Can is their sort of home base chamber music ensemble. It's a clarinetist, a cellist, a pianist, a percussionist. And for instance, the about 5 years ago, Julia Wolf's fantastically beautiful oratorio, Anthracite Fields, won the Pulitzer. And that's the piece I got to do with Bang on a Can. It was written for them and a choir. They were touring through the Midwest, and we were chosen to do a performance with them, which is a highlight of my career for sure.
Wow. Yeah, it's like that caught my eyes. And here's a man who could do Bach, like standing on his head, and this Bang on a Can thing just kind of flashed out.
I love their name. They're incredibly virtuosic musicians, but the name gives you a sense of play and a sense of that, you know, that they're playing with what sound can be expressive, even if it's not what other people think might be beautiful.
Vernon, let me ask you, I'm going to ask you about the repertoire for the evening so people have an idea of what it is. But before that, Andrew, which of the pieces are you conducting for the festival?
With the college choir, I'll be working on a Bach motet called Der Geisthilft, Schwachheit auf by Bach. Adam Lubke, who is their conductor, was a student of mine in many years ago. And so I think he knew my particular love for Bach. And so when he asked me to do that, of course, I jumped at that. With Camerata, I'll be doing a wonderful piece by the contemporary American composer Gwyneth Walker called I Will Be Earth. It's a very beautiful and slightly strange poem by Mae Swenson that I find really, really beautiful. The piece that I'm doing with Vernon Squire is a piece that's new to me, so I'll let him talk about that a little bit, because it's one I'm just getting to know and really enjoying. And then the combined piece I'll be doing with all of them is Aaron Copland's The Promise of Living, which is
fantastic.
It was originally the finale to one of the acts of his opera, The Tenderland. But for me, it's one of the great texts for collegiate settings, because it's about a young person's dreams and how they change the world and make it a better place, and how the dreams become not just about sort of an individual success, but about a way of making the world a better community. Vernon, do you want to say something about the piece I'll be doing with your choir? Because it is a piece that you know better than I do, and I'm really looking forward to getting to know it.
Sure. since we just performed at Boston day before yesterday, I chose a piece that we would be doing for that concert, and it's by Karen Seigel. It's a piece called To Be Free, just written in 2018, and it uses the old text, 'Tis a Gift to Be Simple, written by Beckett in 1848. And then she took that text and tune and expanded upon it. And it also talks about living in community and when we're all together and can grow together. It's a deliciously complex piece. And so I was talking to my students about it, that I can't wait for Andrew to get his hands on it to see what he can do, and hopefully some very different things with it too, so they can learn that way also.
Vernon, are there any like other pieces besides just those four, or is it a full evening?
It's not one of our 2.5 hour evenings. Okay. We might do sometime around the, you know, the winter holidays. Each choir will sing three pieces, uh-huh. and Andrew will conduct one of each set, and then we'll bring on all of the mighty forces of the Fredonia choirs at the end for the final Copland piece. So I think the concert should be no more than about 50 minutes. It really sort of will showcase what our audition choirs can do.
Yes, absolutely. Vernon, who's sponsoring this? You have sponsors that are helping you support this?
We do. Three different groups. We're lucky that the School of Music is helping to sponsor this. Also, we were able to get a grant from the Carnahan Jackson Fund for the Humanities for the 9th year in a row. And then I'm so excited that they'll be participating in this. Our student chapter of the American Choral Directors Association will be helping sponsor this. And so our president will introduce Andrew at the lecture on Friday, and then he's agreed to talk with them Saturday morning to sort of have a brunch with them so he can share his experiences, you know, and they can feel free to ask him anything away from our glaring eyes.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, Vernon, listen, I wish you the best of luck. I know it's going to be a wonderful event for you. Andrew McGill, thank you very much for coming. It's been a real pleasure to talk to such a distinguished gentleman in the art form. And thank you both for your time. Good luck with the concert.
Thank you.
Pleasure to speak with you.
Dr. McGill will be delivering his lecture on Friday, February 18th at 12:40 p.m. in the Rausch Recital Hall. And the Choral Festival concert will take place on Saturday, February 19th at 4 p.m., featuring the Fredonia Camerata, the Chamber Choir, and the College Choir. Tickets are $8 for the general public and free for students if they obtain them at the box office before the performance. Tickets can be obtained at the campus box office online or by calling 716-673-3501.
Bart, any last requests?
Well, there is one, but... Nah.
No, go on.
Well, you have such a beautiful voice.
Guilty as charged.
Uh-huh. Anyway, I was wondering if you could sing the entire score of the HMS Pinafore.
Very well, Bart. I shall send you to heaven before I send you to hell. And a two, and a three, and... We sail the ocean blue, and our saucy ships of beauty. We are sober men...
Stories of post-apocalyptic societies abound. But playwright Anne Washburn has given this particular genre an interesting twist. In her play, Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, her post-apocalyptic characters concern themselves with trying to remember and recreate an episode of The Simpsons. Dan Lenzian, of the faculty of the Department of Theater and Dance, is the director of this unusual and somewhat timely piece of theater. Once again, it's a pleasure to bring to the podcast and say hello to Dan Lenzian. Dan Lenzian is a lecturer at the Department of Theater and Dance at SUNY Fredonia, and he's putting on what I have found out is to be a very unusual production called Mr. Burns, a post-electric play. So I guess, Dan, the first thing I'm going to do is just sort of let you describe it to the listeners rather than me. You're probably a little bit more versed in that.
We should hope, right? If you're like, oh, no, tell me about it, Tom. Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, is a play that was written in 2012. It had a life in New York at Playwrights Horizons. And it tells, it's basically three one-act plays that are put together to create an evening of theater. In the first act, a group of people are around a campfire after a sort of life-changing global event, retelling an episode of The Simpsons, the Cape Fear episode that was really one that was sort of remembered. The second act is 7 years in the future, where a group of actors are trying to stage that same episode of Mr. Burns now as a stage play, or that same episode of The Simpsons as a stage play. And then the third act is a musical almost as if almost sort of treating the Simpsons in the same way that sort of contemporary theater makers might treat Greek theater or Shakespeare theater, sort of with the best of intentions and trying to understand things, but maybe getting some things wrong or some things have been lost maybe in translation, like a game of telephone.
Do you have any idea why the playwright, I believe her name is Anne Washburn, if I remember correctly, why she chose the Simpsons as the sort of the focal point of this attempt?
Yeah, the playwright wanted something contemporary and wanted something that people knew. And if we think about it, the Simpsons has been on for most of my lifetime. I remember when the Simpsons premiered. And I remember the specific episode that's being talked about here. And she states in some interviews and my sort of initial research about the play that they were thinking about kind of experimenting with other sitcoms from the 90s or things like that. But The Simpsons really stuck. I also think that there's something about a cartoon that works differently than, let's say, something like a sitcom. And I think that that was another reason why Washburn decided to kind of use The Simpsons.
What do you think makes The Simpsons, because personally I find this choice to be great in terms of the play that they actually chose The Simpsons, but what do you find about The Simpsons, having grown up with it, that sort of stands out to you as saying, man, they couldn't have done any better than pick The Simpsons in terms of an American iconic, you know, creation?
I think the length of time that The Simpsons has been on is really interesting, because there's also been a lot of conversation about shifting the narrative and some of the characters. And I think they've done a really great job of kind of always being ahead on the forefront of a lot of conversation, a lot of social conversation, a lot of social commentary, and a lot of social critique that the show itself has certainly not been, has not necessarily shied away from in recent years. I also think that I remember specifically as a child kind of a change where it was looked at as an adult cartoon in, I think, 1988. And I remember not being allowed to watch it. And then something shifted where for about probably 2 years, I think my family watched it all together on Sunday nights when it kind of premiered. So it went from being something that was completely sort of looked at as adult to something that then my family at that time could watch. And I would imagine that's probably true for other listeners of the podcast. I do think, too, that it's irreverent, like I said, and has that social critique, but also has real characters that, although they don't age, do have different, have a real emotional life. Homer, Marge, Bart, Maggie, and Lisa are so familiar to us because they've been around so long. And although they don't age, they have grown, changed, and there's an emotional complexity to them.
Now, does any of that carry over in the play? And by that, what I mean is, are the characters in the play trying to recall this episode of The Simpsons because they find the social satire interesting or significant, or are they just trying to capture this particular episode of the play because they need entertainment?
Well, I think that, you know, I think that it's really connected in this particular play to entertainment. And this particular episode of The Simpsons they talk about is the Cape Fear episode, which satirizes the De Niro film, which then kind of references an earlier film, which then references a novel. And so I would say that within this play, sampling and kind of referencing or referential humor, which I think The Simpsons has always done really well, is part of kind of like the makeup of this play. And so I think that the kind of that episode has so many kind of look backs and references that the play sort of mirrors that same structure, and that the third act mirrors the second act, which mirrors the first act. And so I also think that that episode, when you think about the Cape Fear episode of The Simpsons, Sideshow Bob, who's being played by Kelsey Grammer, and that episode is trying to kill Bart. And I think that it's an episode that when you talk about The Simpsons to people, they have an awareness of that episode. And what Washburn did was asked actors to watch this. And it was a group of, she partnered with a group called the Civilians in New York, who are a theater company, and asked them to recall it from memory. And so a lot of the first act is kind of based upon that workshop, and the actors' names in the script are, or the character names in the script are literally named after the actors. So like Maria is Maria Dizia, Quincy is Quincy Tyler Bernstein, and that's kind of how the play was created.
Now, what really fascinated me about the play was that the subtitle, a post-electric play. Now, in this post-apocalyptic world that the playwright has created, there's no electricity. So as a consequence, there's no screens at all. My understanding is that the society, the world in which the play takes place, has no screens, no television, no internet, no nothing. Is that mm-hmm. how are your student actors relating to that reality within the world of the play?
That's great. You know, what a great question. The student actors that are working on this play really are fantastic, and it's a fantastic cast. And they've just been working together so well. I started kind of in my process of working on plays to, like, rather than a traditional sort of table work, meaning that, like, we would sit down and just sort of discuss for hours and hours and hours. I started in my work creating kind of mini versions of, or sort of exercises that are connected to the to, like, what happens in the play, right? So for every play that I'm directing now, I'm trying to find something that can kind of unlock something within the play that's not necessarily directly related to the play. And so for this play, I asked them, I showed them three commercials from the 90s, mm-hmm. And I asked them to recreate those commercials in the acting studio as best they could with the stuff that they had. And then we watched those, and then I said, great, now this has become a musical, and I'd like you to add music and songs to it. And they created these, like, fascinating, like, one of the commercials that they worked on was the Elizabeth Taylor perfume, where she says, you know, she takes the earring off and says, "This has always brought me luck." And, you know, they were singing songs about diamonds, and it was fascinating to watch their work. And that really taught them, like, oh, this is the entertainment in this play. Like, we can't look at screens anymore. We have to work through our memory of what we thought we saw. And I felt like that exercise was so successful in unlocking it for them. And we're continually learning throughout the process of what it would be like, and, you know, imagining what that could be like. And, you know, the great thing about the play too is, like, when you're on, you really don't leave. So there isn't even a chance to kind of, you know, some modern plays now, like, you're in the first scene and then you're off three and you can check the phone. But once this starts, they don't leave, and they can't have a phone in their hand. It's just not there. So I think it's been a great experiment for them. And I think that exercise unlocked a lot for them within the play.
This play fascinates me, actually. I haven't read the play because I couldn't get a copy of it, but I try to do as much research as I can. The second act is this collection of people going from trying to just simply recreating the memories to transforming the memories into being some kind of theatrical acting company. They want to create a play out of it. What do you think this says about the nature of humans to have to sort of tell their stories to each other? Is that reflected in mm-hmm. the second act at all?
So I think the need for story and the need to want to tell story and reflect experience is kind of, like, really hardwired into human beings, and really is ultimately, I think, what it means to be human, right? The ability to tell story. So in the second act, there is a desire to create these sort of, they call them commercials, but to nostalgize things that have been gone, and I think a humorous and a little bit sort of sad way. And I think that it's, I'm interested to see how audiences respond to it, because the playwright is incredible, but you have to lean in, and nothing is sort of easily spelled out for you in terms of, like, here's what's happening now. Like, it takes a minute, you're experiencing something, and then, you know, a little bit later you realize, like, what was happening. And so I'm excited to see how audiences respond to it. And I really hope that they come with an open mind and are ready to kind of experience story and make meaning from what they see.
I know. I think the whole concept really is sort of fascinating. And I'm going to ask you a sort of a final question about the play, because each act has its own, I haven't read it, but each act seems to have its own reflection of the human condition, whereas the first act, you know, is like everybody's trying to get there just to remember what happened, and the second act is they're trying to get the stage company to be able to tell these stories. But the last act, 75 years after the unnamed apocalyptic event, once again humans are reinstitutionalizing that whole thing. Mm-hmm. So they've mm-hmm. created it to the point where I think the descriptions are that, you know, the Simpsons all of a sudden become, you know, as important to this culture as a Greek tragedy is to Western civilization, let's say.
Right. Homer is Hamlet.
Right. Homer is Hamlet. And now I don't know if that's what's happening in your play at all, but I know that sense of institutionalizing something, of making it an institutional thing, the way, like, you know, Greek theater became institutionalized for the Greeks in 500 BCE. Is that how are you looking at that in terms of presenting that to the audience?
One of the kind of phrases that I've been thinking about a lot with this is like, without this whole sort of process of this play, is recycling the myths of yesterday create mm-hmm. meaning for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And so for me, what became really interesting was imagining what would be available or accessible in 75 years and you know, kind of after this post-apocalyptic event, and what post-apocalyptic theater would look like and what would be required and what would be sort of holy in that world and what would still be available. And so I found that to be really interesting. And the way I've kind of pictured this is like, at one time, sort of in all ancient civilizations across the world, there was a holy place where stories were enacted so that other people could see. And this is sort of across all cultures, whether you look at Greece or India or anywhere like that.
Right.
And so I thought, what would happen if the space in which this first two acts were taking became like a consecrated space where these stories were told, and what would still be available? And so like, and I thought, well, what if this particular space that we are in kind of became consecrated for this Simpsons performance?
Yeah.
And that became really interesting to me.
And it's very interesting because to me, the layers there are incredible in the sense that, you know, you're taking what is what we consider to be pop culture, but then all of a sudden, 75 years later, they're raising it to the point of high culture. And the contrast in there, I can't decide if it's ironic. I can't decide if it's, you know, what I would take away from that.
Yeah, well, and I think that the playwright is, there's a whole section in the second act that's talking about, like, you know, finding meaning, or is finding meaning important, right? And the playwright herself is asking these questions. But I also think, though, that, like, when we think about, historical things, like sometimes if you think about, you know, Shakespeare performance, there were groundlings there, and there were people selling oranges during the show, and it wasn't sort of, more accessible perhaps than sometimes it's looked at now, right? And that we sometimes will elevate things 75 years, or, you know, painters or all art sometimes will get elevated after a certain amount of time, right? Like when we look at, let's say, you know, rock musicians from the 60s, at the time they were just sort of bards playing, and now they're looked at as like, oh my gosh, you know, like the sort of the greatest storytellers of the generation. So I think that a kind of ascent from something being kind of quotidian culture to high culture is always happening.
All right. Well, I could talk about this all day, but I think I'm going to leave it at there, Dan, because it just sounds like such a fascinating little piece of work. And I have to congratulate you for bringing to, you know, the department and even the region, these kinds of work. So keep it up. All right. Okay. Thanks, Dan. We'll put all the information and times and stuff afterwards, so, you know, you don't have to recount all of that. Okay.
Thank you very much. Take care.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Bye-bye.
Mr. Burns, a post-electric play, runs in the Bartlett Theater for 2 weekends. It opens Friday, February 25th, and runs the 25th, 26th, and again Thursday through Saturday, March 3rd, 4th, and 5th at 7:30 p.m., with a matinee Sunday, February 27th at 2 p.m. Tickets are available online through the campus box office at www.fredonia.edu/tickets, or by calling the box office at 716-673-3501. Here's what else is going on in the region for the next 2 weeks. At the 1891 Fredonia Opera House, the cinema series continues with the screening of the movie Delicious. Set in France in 1789, the film tells the story of the first restaurant as a chef who is sacked by his master, the Duke of Chamfort, goes on to open a restaurant where all are welcome. In French with English subtitles, Delicious plays on Saturday, February 19th, and again on Tuesday, February 22nd at 7:30 p.m. Tickets are available at the 1891 Fredonia Opera House by calling 716-679-1891. There are several arts events coming up on the campus of SUNY Fredonia. In addition to the three events featured in this episode, you can catch the following events. The All College Band, conducted by Carrie Poleski, will be performing in King Concert Hall on Wednesday, February 23rd at 8 p.m. The Fredonia Wind Ensemble, conducted by Donna Dolson, performs the following evening, Thursday, February 24th at 8 p.m. in King Concert Hall. The Wind Ensemble performs once again on Saturday, February 26th at 8 p.m. also in King Concert Hall, this time under the baton of Dr. Paula Holcomb. The Fredonia String Festival takes place on Sunday, February 27th, with a series of master classes from guest artists from 1 to 3:30 p.m. in various locations in Mason Hall, and concluding with a festival concert at 5 p.m. in Rausch Recital Hall. All these music events are free and open to the public. The third annual Robert Jordan Piano Festival also begins on Monday, February 28th, and continues through Sunday, March 6th, with a series of master classes and recitals. Please consult the Fredonia events calendar at events.fredonia.edu/music for detailed information. And finally, the Marion Art Gallery will have an opening reception on Friday, February 25th, beginning at 6 p.m., for its latest exhibit, New Shapes from Old Tropes. Curated by John Massier, this exhibition features contemporary paintings, drawings, sculptures, and photographs by artists residing in the Buffalo area. The exhibit is on display until Sunday, April 10th. If you'd like your arts event mentioned on the podcast, just send us an email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Please allow 4 weeks advance notice for a timely mention. Generally, when I think of jazz, I tend to think of 3 to 5 musicians playing in a small, smoke-filled, dimly lit room to a collection of young urbanites doing their utmost to appear cool. While that may be one stereotypical image of jazz, the art form itself is much more varied and nuanced than that. Dr. Nick Weiser, who is the head of jazz studies at Fredonia School of Music, is bent on creating a far more innovative jazz program for the times we currently live in. I got the chance to speak with him about his vision for the program and the upcoming Fredonia Jazz Orchestra concert. Well, I have finally got a chance to meet Nick Weiser, and Nick is an assistant professor over at the SUNY Fredonia School of Music, and he is in charge of jazz studies over at SUNY Fredonia. So, Nick, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Tom. Appreciate being here.
Let me start by asking you a little bit about your background, how you came to like jazz and stuff like that. I'm a jazz aficionado from way back. You know, I love the art form, actually, but let me talk about you, because you play and everything like that. I'm just a listener.
Yeah, so I grew up in a small town out in southwest Kansas, and my parents were both small town, small business owners there. My father owned a bar and worked his own construction company. My mother owned her own hair salon. And in my father's bar and restaurant was the family piano that he inherited from my great-grandfather. It was purchased in 1895. And so my initial interest in music making actually came up pretty organically. You know, I'd go down to my parents' businesses after school in a small town of about 1,000 people. I could walk over there pretty easily. And while I was waiting for my parents to take me home, I sort of developed an interest in the family piano, and that's kind of what got me started. They noticed that I was able to pick out tunes that I would hear on the radio, and thought that maybe I would have some inclination toward music making. And so my mother asked if I wanted to take piano lessons, not expecting me to say yes, and certainly not expecting my dad to move about a 550-pound instrument into our house. But I did, and he did, and that's kind of how things began for me. So, you know, I took traditional piano lessons up front and learned the technical side of the instrument, and really developed a love for playing written classical music. But I always had an interest in putting my own spin on things, and they figured out over time that I might have a jazz bent. So I started working with some other musicians in the region. This is out in Southwest Kansas, other musicians out in the region. And as you can imagine, there's kind of a dearth of good musicians in rural Southwest Kansas, but we were really fortunate to have a couple of really fantastic educators and a performer out there by the name of Frank Mantooth, who brought me into the jazz fold. Great jazz performer, composer, arranger. He's another pianist out there. And so in spite of its ruralness, I was able to get some really great instruction out there, and went to the University of Kansas for my undergraduate in classical piano performance. But the entire time I was out there, I was really heavily involved in the jazz program. And over time, and as I realized that I could make some money playing jazz, that ultimately won out. And I pursued a jazz studies degree, or a jazz studies master's and doctorate from the Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York. And that's what brought me to the region.
So the jazz studies program, you've taken it over. And what directions do you want to see that program, or what directions are you pushing that program towards?
Yeah, let me give you a little history on the program first.
Please, do so.
There's been a jazz presence on Fredonia's campus since 1934. But up until 2017, when I was hired, it was largely student-run. Bruce Johnstone came on. I don't know what year he started working there, but it was to help formalize the jazz offerings that the college had. Uh-huh. And so he had a couple of ensembles I think he was working with. John Bacon was working with the Latin Jazz Ensemble before I got there. And they were sort of shepherding the jazz program in a more official way, but they didn't offer a degree in jazz until 2017, which is what I was hired to help create and to build, essentially. So now we have a formal BA in music with a jazz studies track that that offers students the opportunity to formalize their study specifically in jazz here. So as with, well, jazz and a lot of higher education, it always seems to lag behind or not get quite quite the same attention or the same resources as a lot of other programs in higher education. That's been a systemic problem for decades. So it's nice to see that we have something that's at least recognized and gets a lot of support. But for me, it's really been an amazing opportunity to be able to come in from square one and have, you know, to a large degree, carte blanche to do what I want, to build the program that I envision. And, you know, tenure track positions in jazz don't come up very often. And positions where you get to direct your own program and create your own program come up even less often. And I was living in Ithaca, so I wanted to stay in this region before moving here. And so this, in this particular area, this part of the country, just like the perfect storm opportunity as far as a position goes. And the college and my administrators and advisors, they've all been so supportive of the program in terms of allowing me to kind of take it in the direction that I had imagined. And it's very important to me to create a program that acknowledges where we're headed as a society, and to create a program that really has, if you look at the history of the music, it's been all about, I mean, jazz is a social music, so it's been about reacting to or against what's going on in the world. And and creating a really powerful commentary on that. So I decided I would rebrand the two large jazz ensembles, and so I created the Fredonia Jazz Orchestra, in keeping with a lot of the great jazz bands historically. My idea was that would become our flagship jazz ensemble, the community-facing jazz ensemble. The idea there is that they play kind of a wide swath of the repertoire, both historical, like great historical classic jazz band arrangements from all of the heavy-hitting arrangers and composers, as well as anything that might come up when we have, a guest artist in with us. Last semester, we featured Kim Nazarian, who's one of the founding members of the New York Voices Jazz Quartet, vocal mm-hmm. jazz quartet. This semester, that group's going to feature another guest artist, Brad Lely, from the University of North Texas. He teaches jazz saxophone at the University of North Texas. So he'll be here and performing with us on April 1st. But the other ensemble that I created, and this is one where I really got to dig into a specific niche that's really important to me, is the New Jazz Ensemble. I created the Fredonia New Jazz Ensemble to explore and perform works by female composers, composers of color, primarily living composers, and otherwise underrepresented composers. It has more of a world music bent, and the things that we explore in that ensemble are typically very different than what a lot of traditionalists would call jazz music. So it's sort of the cutting edge of the large ensemble repertoire. And in the second year of the program, I believe it was the first concert that group with that name gave at Fredonia. I submitted the recordings from that performance to Downbeat Magazine for consideration in their Student Music Awards, which is an mm-hmm. annual music award, recognizes the highest achieving ensembles in the world. And we won an award for outstanding performance by a large jazz ensemble.
Nice, very good.
In the second year of the program, that was such an incredible validation and a great boost to the momentum of the program. So in the course of the pandemic, I had to reimagine that ensemble because we didn't have as many players available to us, and we certainly couldn't rehearse in person for a while. So I wanted something that was a little bit smaller, a little bit more lithe, that I could, so I could still have a group that could maybe rehearse together and play together a little bit. So I created something out of that group called the Fredonia Jazz Flextet.
Oh.
Basically, it's a group anywhere between a septet and 10 or 11, 12 players, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so it's been really fun to explore kind of the little big band or large combo space, again, with a more modern or contemporary musical bent. There's a lot of great writing that falls within those parameters. And it's been a great exploration of yet another kind of niche in the music.
So you've actually made a very good case, I think. I wasn't even going to ask you this question, but I didn't even have to ask, but you've made mm-hmm. a very good case for, you know, any listener here who's got, children of college age thinking of going to Fredonia for jazz studies. Now, I know that the Fredonia Jazz Orchestra has got a concert coming up on the 22nd. Can you give us a little preview of that? You've got both your jazz orchestra and your flextet playing at that, I understand.
Yeah. It'll be a split program between the two. The flextet's going to do at least a couple of things from a brand new release by Wynton Marsalis and the Jazz at Lincoln Center Septet called mm-hmm. the Democracy Suite. I forget the full title of the tune, but the subtitle is Black Lives Matter. And it's just a really powerful musical statement. And the set as a whole is a really incredible musical set. It has a lot of traditional elements and some really incredible sort of sanctified tambourine playing and really groove-oriented music. But also the the intent behind the music is really powerful. And we'll be doing a number of other selections in that group by living composers. Alan Ferber, who's a great contemporary writer, has an Annette. We're going to be playing a couple of things from his album Roots and Transitions. So that group's going to be showcased heavily in this particular concert. And then the Jazz Orchestra is actually playing a slightly more modern assortment of large jazz ensemble arrangements. We're doing a couple of things by John Clayton and an arrangement by Rich DeRosa. Had Charles Mingus lived, this would be his 100th year. So we're doing doing at least one piece to recognize the centennial year for Charles Mingus.
Charlie Mingus.
We're going to do Fables of Faubus. And the students, of course, because of, I mean, if you know anything about Mingus's music, it's really idiosyncratic. And, you know, he has a deep connection to Ellington. And and so you hear elements of Ellington's kind of writing style and orchestration, but you also get all of the sort of quirkiness and idiosyncrasies of somebody like Monk. And and the students really, really love playing that music.
It sounds like a great combination. It sounds like there's something for everybody. Mm-hmm. Now, you do something down at Domus Fair too, I believe. Is that correct?
That's right. You know, pre-pandemic, it was sort of a steady climb. And we had some great guest artists involved in those concerts. Mark Filsinger out of Buffalo, Dave Chavone also out of Buffalo. And then we started to kind of cast the net a little wider and get, I believe we had Diego Figueiredo, who's a great Brazilian guitarist, just before the pandemic hit. Mm-hmm. And we're excited to be able to bring in two really high-level guest artists in our upcoming concerts, which are February 17th, this coming February 17th, and March 31st. So the guest artists for that will be Kim Nazarian, again, the founding member of the New York Voices, on the 17th, and then Brad Lely from North Texas on March 31st.
31st. Great.
We were able to get some momentum going as a jazz society when we launched our first ever Fredonia Jazz Festival this past September.
Yes.
That was something that took place at the Rotunda Railroad grounds, or Grapevine Railroad grounds. And again, we had an assortment of high school ensembles. So we brought in a handful of groups from the region, and then a couple of collegiate groups, and I think three or four pro groups from Buffalo. And the headlining performer was Delphio Marsalis from New Orleans. So, Leon, just to speak to one more point here, you know, and to kind of circle back around to the pandemic, I think a lot of people took for granted before the pandemic how easy it was and how ubiquitous music and the arts were, how easy it was to attend different events. And so for us, it's been really great to be able to emerge from that and to recreate or start to rebuild that sense of community and to share that music making with, not just with each other in person again, but with the broader community. So it's really been exciting for us to have this opportunity to be able to come out on the other side kind of refreshed and relatively unscathed, you know. Mm-hmm. And so we're just excited to rebuild the community and to have people back in the seats and in attendance at these concerts. So we do hope everybody will come out and support.
I enjoyed talking to you, Nick. Thank you very much. And I know I'm going to be talking to you again sometime in the future. So good luck with the concert and wish you well.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Tom.
Okay. Thank you, Nick. Bye-bye. The Fredonia Jazz Orchestra and Flextet will be playing in the Rausch Recital Hall on Tuesday, February 22nd, beginning at 8 p.m. Don't miss the chance to hear this exciting synergy of the new and the old in jazz. And that's it for this President's Edition of Notes from the Aisle Seat. My thanks to Vernon Huff, Andrew McGill, Dan Lenzian, and Nick Weiser for being my guests on this episode. Notes from the Aisle Seat is a production of the 1891 Fredonia Opera House in Fredonia, New York. For more information on any of the Opera House's events, call their box office at 716-679-1891, visit the website at www.fredopera.org, or email at operahouse@fredopera.org. Notes from the Aisle Seat is now available wherever you get your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. If you like this podcast, please consider following us by clicking the follow button on our website and spreading the word through your social media feeds. If you have an arts event you'd like featured on the podcast, why don't you drop us a line at operahouse@fredopera.org and we'll see about featuring your event. Please try to give us a month's advance notice, if possible, to facilitate timely scheduling. We'll return in 2 weeks on March 2nd, 2022. I'm Tom Laughlin, and until then, be safe out there and be kind to one another.